3 weeks at least. Now they stood together on the smooth, freezing stone floor, abjectly human. How could a person who hadn't washed or cut her hair in 5 months be so beautiful?
"I don't know," he said. His voice was scratchy from lack of use. The words felt more frightening than any spell he had ever cast.
"I mean, you'd think I would, but I don't. I really don't know."
He tried to make his tone light and conversational, but his body felt heavy. The floor was accelerating rapidly upward with both of them on it. At that moment, when he should have been most lucidly present, he had no idea whether he was lying or telling the truth. With all the time he'd spent studying here, everything he'd learned, why hadn't he learned this one thing? He was failing both of them, himself and Alice.
"It's okay," she said,
with a quick little smile that strained the ligaments that held Quentin's heart in his chest.
"I didn't think so. I was more wondering whether you would lie about it."
He was lost.
"Was I supposed to lie?" "It's okay, Quentin. It was nice. The sex, I mean. You do realize it's all right to have nice things sometimes, right?"
She saved him from having to answer by standing up on tiptoe and kissing him softly on the lips. Her lips were dry and chapped, but the tip of her tongue was soft and warm. It felt like the last warm thing in the world.
"Try not to die," she said.
She patted his rough cheek and disappeared down the stairs ahead of him in the pre-dawn twilight. After that ordeal, the test was almost an afterthought. They were released separately out onto the snowpack at intervals to discourage collaboration. Mayakovsky made Quentin disrobe first, so much for the flour and the garlic and that bent silver fork, and walk naked out beyond the range of the protective spells that kept the temperature bearable at Breakbills South. As he passed through the invisible perimeter, the cold hit him face first, and it was beyond all belief. Quentin's whole body spasmed and contracted. It felt like he'd been dropped into burning kerosene. The air seared his lungs. He bent over, hands jammed in his armpits.
"Happy trails," Mayakovsky called.
He tossed Quentin a Ziploc bag full of something gray and greasy. Mutton fat.
"Bog s vami."
Whatever. Quentin knew he had only a few seconds before his fingers would be too numb for spell casting. He tore open the bag and jammed his hands inside and stuttered out Shkarchisvili's enveloping warmth. It got easier after that. He layered on the rest of the spells by turns. Protection from the wind and the sun. Speed. Strong legs. Toughened feet. He threw up a navigation spell, and a great luminous golden compass wheel that only he could see appeared overhead in the white sky. Quentin knew the theory behind the spells, but he'd never tested them altogether at full strength. He felt like a superhero. He felt bionic. He was in business. He turned to face the S on the compass wheel and trotted off toward the horizon at speed, circling around the building he'd just left, bare feet fluffing silently through bone-dry powder. With the strength spells in place, his thighs felt like pneumatic pistons. His calves were steel truck springs. His feet were as tough and numb as Kevlar brake shoes. Afterward, he remembered almost nothing of the week that followed. The whole thing was very clinical. Reduced to its technical essence, it was a problem of resource management, of nurturing and guarding and fanning the little flickering flame of life and consciousness within his body as the entire continent of Antarctica tried to leech away the heat and sugar and water that kept it burning. He slept lightly and very little. His urine turned a deep amber, then ceased to flow entirely. The monotony of the scenery was relentless. Each low, crunchy ridge he topped revealed a vista composed of its identical clones, arranged in a pattern of infinite regress. His thoughts went around in circles. He lost track of time. He sang the Oscar Mayer jingle and the Simpsons theme song. He talked to James and Julia. Sometimes he confused James with Martin Chatwin and Julia with Jane. The fat melted out of his body. His ribs grew more prominent, tried to push their way out through his skin. He had to be careful. His margin of error was not large. The spells he was using were powerful and highly durable, with a life of their own. He could die out here, and his corpse would probably keep jogging merrily along toward the pole on its own. Once or twice a day, sometimes more, a lipless blue crevasse would open beneath his feet, and he would have to trot around it or cross it with a magic-assisted leap. Once he stumbled right into one and fell 40 feet down into blue-tinted darkness. The ward and shield spells around his pale, nude body were so thick that he barely noticed. He just ground to a slow stop, jammed in between two rough ice walls, and then lifted himself back out again like the Lorax and kept on running. Even as his physical strength faded, he leaned on the iron magical vigor that his sojourn under Professor Mayakovsky had given him. It no longer felt like a fluke when he worked magic successfully. The worlds of magical and physical reality felt equally real and present to him. He summoned simple spells into being without conscious thought. He reached for the magical force within him as naturally as he would reach for the salt on the dinner table. He had even gained the ability to extemporize a little, to guess at magical circumstances when he hadn't been drilled on them. The implications of this were stunning. Magic wasn't simply random. It had an actual shape, a fractal, chaotic shape, but subconsciously his blindly groping mental fingertips had begun to parse it. He remembered a lecture Mayakovsky had given a few weeks before, which at the time he hadn't paid much attention to. Now, however, jogging forever south across the frozen, broken plains, it came back to him almost word for word. "You dislike me," Mayakovsky had begun. "You are sick of the sight of me, skraelings." That was what he called them, skraelings. Apparently it was a Viking word that meant roughly wretches. "But if you listen to me only one more time in your lives, listen to me now. Once you reach a certain level of fluency as a spellcaster, you will begin to manipulate reality freely. Not all of you. Dale, I think you in particular are unlikely to cross that Rubicon. But for some of you, spells will one day come very easily, almost automatically, with very little in the way of conscious effort. When the change comes, I ask only that you know it for what it is, and be aware. For the true magician, there is no very clear line between what lies inside the mind and what lies outside it. If you desire something, it will become substance. If you despise it, you will see it destroyed. A master magician is not much different from a child or a madman in that respect. It takes a very clear head and a very strong will to operate once you are in that place. And you will find out very quickly whether or not you have
that clarity, and that strength.
Mayakovsky stared out at their silent faces a moment longer with undisguised disgust, then stepped down from the lectern.
Age, Quentin heard him mutter. It's wasted on the young. Just like youth.
When night finally fell, the stars burned shrilly overhead with impossible force and beauty. Quentin jogged with his head up, knees high, no longer feeling anything below his waist, gloriously isolated, lost in the spectacle. He became nothing, a running wraith, a wisp of warm flesh in a silent universe of midnight frost. Once, for a few minutes, the darkness was disturbed by a flickering on the horizon. He realized it must be another student, another Skraeling, like himself, moving on a parallel path but way off to the east, 20 or 30 miles at least, and ahead of him. He thought about changing course to make contact. But seriously, what was the point? Why should he risk getting busted for collaborating just to say hi? What did he, a wraith, a wisp of warm flesh, need with anybody else? Whoever it was, he thought dispassionately, was using a different set of spells than he was. He couldn't piece out the magic at this distance, but they were throwing off a whole lot of pale, pink-white light. Inefficient, he thought. Inelegant. When the sun rose, he lost sight of the other student again. Some immeasurable period of time later, Quentin blinked. He had lost the habit of closing his magically weatherproofed eyes, but something was bothering him. It was a matter for concern, though he could barely formulate why in any conscious, coherent way. There was a black spot in his vision. The landscape had, if anything, gotten more monotonous. Far behind him were the moments when streaks of dark, frozen schist occasionally marred the white snow. Once he'd passed what he was fairly sure was a fallen meteorite stuck in the ice, a lump of something black like a lost charcoal briquette, but that was a long time ago. He was far gone. After days without real sleep, his mind was a machine for monitoring spells and moving his feet, nothing else. But while he was checking off anomalies, there was something screwy going on with his compass wheel, too. It wobbled erratically, and it was getting kind of distorted. The inn had grown vast and swollen. It was taking up 5/6 of the circle, and the other directions had withered away to almost nothing. The S he was supposed to be following had shrunk to a tiny squiggle in microscopic jewel type. The black spot was taller than it was wide, and it bobbed up and down with his stride the way an external object would. So it wasn't corneal damage, and it was growing larger and larger, too. It was Mayakovsky, standing by himself in the powdery nothingness, holding a blanket. He must be at the pole. Quentin had completely forgotten where he was going or why. When he got close enough, Mayakovsky caught him. The tall man grunted, wrapping the heavy, scratchy blanket around him, and swung him down to the snow. Quentin's legs kept moving for a few seconds, then he lay still, panting, on his side, twitching like a netted fish. It was the first time in 9 days that he'd stopped running. The sky spun. He retched. Mayakovsky stood over him.
Molodets, Quentin. Good man. Good man. You made it. You are going home.
There was something odd in Mayakovsky's voice. The sneer was gone, and it was thick with emotion. A twisted smile revealed for a moment the older wizard's yellow teeth in his unshaven face. He hauled Quentin to his feet with one hand. The other hand he flourished, and a portal appeared in the air. He shoved Quentin unceremoniously through it. Quentin staggered and fell into a psychedelic riot of green that assaulted him so violently that at first he didn't recognize it as the rear terrace of Brakebills on a hot summer day. After the blankness of the polar ice, the campus was a hallucinatory swirl of sound and color and warmth. He squeezed his eyes tight shut. He was home. He rolled over on his back on the baking smooth stone. Birds sang deafeningly. He opened his eyes. A sight even stranger than the trees and the grass met them. Looking back through the portal, he could still see the tall, soft-shouldered magician standing there with Antarctica in the background. Snow kicked up around him. A few stray crystals drifted through and evaporated in mid-flight. It looked like a painting executed on an oval panel and hung in mid-air. But the magical window was already closing. He must be preparing himself to go back to his empty, polar mansion, Quentin thought. He waved, but Mayakovsky wasn't looking at him. He was looking out at the maze and the rest of the Brakebills campus. The unguarded longing on his face was so excruciating, Quentin had to look away. Then the portal closed. It was over. It was late May, and the air was full of pollen. After the rarefied atmosphere of Antarctica, it tasted hot and thick as soup. It was a lot like that first day he'd come to Brakebills, straight through from that frigid Brooklyn afternoon. The sun beat down. He sneezed. They were all waiting for him, or almost all. Elliot and Josh and Janet, at least, wearing their old school uniforms, looking fat and happy and relaxed and none the worse for wear, like they'd done nothing for the past 6 months but sit on their asses and eat grilled cheese sandwiches. "Welcome back," Elliot said. He was munching a yellow pear. "They only told us 10 minutes ago you might be coming through."
"Wow," Josh's eyes were round. "Man, you look skinny. Wizard needs food badly, and also maybe a shower."
Quentin knew he had only a minute or two before he burst into tears and passed out. He still had Mayakovsky's scratchy wool blanket wrapped around him. He looked down at his pale, frozen feet. Nothing looked frostbitten anyway, though one of his toes was sticking out at an angle. It didn't hurt yet. It was very, very comfortable, deliriously comfortable, lying on his back on the hot stone like this, with the others looking down at him. He knew he should probably get up for the sake of politeness, if for no other reason, but he didn't feel like moving yet. He thought he might just stay where he was for another minute. He had earned himself a rest.
"Are you all right?" Josh said. "What was it like?"
"Alice kicked your ass," Janet said. "She got back 2 days ago. She already went home."
"You were out there a week and a half," Elliot said. "We were worried about you."
Why did they keep talking? If he could just gaze up at them in silence, that would be perfect. Just look at them and listen to the chirping birds and feel the warm flagstones holding him up. And maybe somebody could get him a glass of water. He was desperately thirsty. He tried to articulate this last sentiment, but his throat was dry and cracked. He wound up just making a tiny creaking noise.
"Oh, I think he wants to know about us," Janet said.
She took a bite of Elliot's pear.
"Yeah, nobody else went out but you two."
"What, you think we're stupid?"
Alice. Quentin didn't spend any time in Brooklyn that summer because his parents didn't live there anymore. Abruptly and without consulting him, they'd sold off their Park Slope townhouse for a colossal sum and semi-retired to a faux colonial McMansion in a placid suburb of Boston called Chesterton, where Quentin's mother could paint full-time and his father could do God only knew what. The shock of being severed from the place he grew up in was all the more surprising because it never really came. Quentin looked for the part of him that should have missed his old neighborhood, but it wasn't there. He supposed he must have been shedding his old identity and his old life all along without noticing it. This just made the cut cleaner and neater. Really, it was probably easier this way. Not that his parents had made the move out of kindness or any logic other than the obvious financial one. The Chesterton house was yellow with green shutters and sat on an acre so aggressively landscaped that it looked like a virtual representation of itself. Though it was trimmed and detailed in a vaguely colonial style, it was so enormous, bulging in all directions with extra wings and gables and roofs, that it looked like it had been inflated rather than constructed. Huge cement air-conditioning bunkers hummed outside night and day. It was even more unreal than the real world usually was. When Quentin arrived home for summer vacation, Brakebill's summer, September for the rest of the world, his parents were alarmed at his gaunt appearance, his hollow, shell-shocked eyes, his haunted demeanor. But their curiosity about him was, as always, mild enough to be easily manageable, and he started gaining weight back quickly with the help of their massive, ever-full suburban refrigerator. At first it was a relief just to be warm all the time, and to sleep in every day, and to be free of Mayakovsky and the circumstances and that merciless white winter light. But after 72 hours, Quentin was already bored again. In Antarctica, he'd fantasized about having nothing to do except lie on his bed and sleep and stare into space, but now those empty hours were here, and they were getting old amazingly fast. The long silences at Brakebill South had made him impatient with small talk. He had no interest in TV anymore. It looked like an electronic puppet show to him, an artificial version of an imitation world that meant nothing to him anyway. Real life, or was it fantasy life, whichever one Brakebill's was, that was what mattered, and that was happening somewhere else. As he usually did when he was stuck at home, he went on a fillery binge. The old 1970s-era covers looked more and more dated every time he saw them, with their psychedelic yellow submarine palette, and on a couple of them the covers had come off completely and been tucked back between the pages as bookmarks. But the world inside the books was as fresh and vital as ever, unfaded and unironized by time. Quentin had never before really appreciated the cleverness of the second book, The Girl Who Told Time, in which Rupert and Helen are abruptly shanghaied into Fillory, straight out of their respective boarding schools, the only time the Chatwins cross over in winter instead of summer. They end up back in an earlier time period, one that overlaps with the storyline of the first book. With the aid of foreknowledge, Rupert dogs Martin's and Helen's footsteps, the earlier Helen's, as they repeat the action of the world in the walls, note for note. He keeps just out of view, dropping clues and helping them out without their knowledge. The mysterious character known only as the Wood One turns out to have been Rupert in disguise. Quentin wondered if Plover wrote The Girl Who Told Time just to shore up all the plot holes in The World in the Walls. Meanwhile, Helen embarks on a hunt for the mysterious questing beast of Fillory, which, according to legend, can't be caught, but if you do catch it, all logic aside, it's supposed to give you your heart's desire. The beast leads her on a tricksy, circuitous chase that somehow winds in and out of the enchanted tapestries that adorn the library of Castle Whitespire. She only ever catches a glimpse of it peeking coyly out at her from behind an embroidered shrub before vanishing in a flicker of cloven hooves. At the end, the twin rams, Ember and Umber, show up, as usual, like a pair of sinister ruminant constables. They were a force for good, of course, but there was a slightly Orwellian quality to their oversight of Fillory. They knew everything that went on, and there was no obvious limit to their powers, but they rarely bestirred themselves to actively intervene on behalf of the creatures in their charge. Mostly they just scolded everybody involved for the mess they'd made, finishing each other's sentences, then made everyone renew their vows of fealty before wandering away to crop some luckless farmer's alfalfa fields. They firmly usher Rupert and Helen back into the real world, back into the damp, chilly, dark wood-paneled halls of their boarding schools, as if they had never left it. Quentin even plowed through The Wandering Dune, the fifth and last book in the series, that is, the last as far as anybody but Quentin knew, and not a fan favorite. It was longer by half than any of the other books, and starred Helen and the youngest Chatwin, clever, introverted Jane. The tone of The Wandering Dune is different from earlier books, having spent the last two volumes searching fruitlessly for their vanished brother, Martin. The Chatwins' usual cheery English indomitability has been tempered by a wistful mood. On entering Fillory, the two girls encounter a mysterious sand dune being blown through the kingdom all by itself. They climb the dune and find themselves riding it through the green Fillorian countryside and on out into a dreamy desert wasteland in the far south, where they spend most of the rest of the book. Almost nothing happens. Jane and Helen fill up the pages with interminable conversations about right and wrong and teenage Christian metaphysics, and whether their true obligations lie on earth or in Fillory. Jane is desperately worried about Martin, but also, like Quentin, a little jealous. Whatever iron law kept the Chatwins from staying in Fillory forever, he had found a loophole, or it had found him. Alive or dead, he had managed to overstay his tourist visa. But Helen, who has a scoldy streak, heaps scorn on Martin. She thinks he's just hiding in Fillory so he won't have to go home. He's the child who doesn't want to leave the playground or who won't go to bed. He's Peter Pan. Why can't he grow up and face the real world? She calls him selfish, self-indulgent, the biggest baby of us all. In the end, the sisters are picked up by a majestic clipper ship that sails through the sand as if it were water. The ship is crewed by large bunnies, who would be overly cutesy. The wandering dune haters always compared them to Ewoks. If it weren't for their impressively hard-assed attention to the technical details of operating their complex vessel. The bunnies leave Jane and Helen with a gift, a set of magical buttons they can use to zap themselves from Earth to Fillory and back at will. On returning to England, Helen, in a fit of self-righteousness, promptly hides the buttons and won't tell Jane where they are, upon which Jane excoriates her in fine period vernacular and turns the entire household upside down and inside out. But she never finds the buttons, and on that unsatisfying note, the book and the whole series ends. Even if it didn't turn out to be the final book in the series, Quentin wondered where Plover could possibly have gone with the story in The Magicians. For one thing, he was out of Chatwins. The books always featured two Chatwin children, an older one from the previous book and a new, younger one. But pretty, dark-haired Jane was the last and youngest Chatwin. Would she have gone back to Fillory alone? It broke the pattern. For another, half of the fun of the books was waiting for the Chatwins to find their way into Fillory, for the magic door that opens for them and them only to appear. You always knew it would, and it always surprised you when it did. But with the buttons you could shuttle back and forth at will. Where was the miracle in that? Maybe that was why Helen hid them. They might as well have built a subway to Fillory. Quentin's conversations with his parents were so circular and self-defeating, they sounded like experimental theater. In the mornings he lay in bed as long as he could stand it, in an attempt to avoid breakfast with them, but they always waited him out. He couldn't win. They had even less to do than he did. Sometimes he wondered if it was a perverse game they played, that they were in on and he wasn't. He would come down to find them sitting at a table littered with crusts and crumbs and clementine peels and cereal bowls. While he pretended to be interested in the Chesterton chestnut, he would furiously search for some even remotely plausible topic of conversation.
"So, are you guys still going on that trip to South America?"
"South America?" His dad looked up, startled, as if he'd forgotten Quentin was there.
"Aren't you going to South America?"
A look passed between Quentin's parents.
"Spain. We're going to Spain and Portugal."
"Oh, Portugal, right. I was thinking Peru for some reason."
"Spain and Portugal?
It's for your mother. There's an artist's exchange with the university in Lisbon. Then we're going to take a boat trip down the Tigris."
"Tagus, darling," Quentin's mother said, with her tinkling "I married an idiot" laugh.
"The Tagus. The Tigris is in Iraq."
She bit into a piece of raisin toast with her large, straight teeth.
"Well, I don't think we'll be sailing down the Tigris any time soon."
Quentin's father laughed loudly at this, exactly as if it were funny, and then paused for thought.
"Darling, do you remember that week we spent in a houseboat on the Volga?"
An extended Russian reminiscence followed, a duet punctuated by significant silences that Quentin interpreted as allusions to sexual activities that he didn't want to know about. It was enough to make you envy the Chatwins, with Dad in the army and Mum in the madhouse. Mayakovsky would have known what to do with this kind of conversation. He would have silenced it. He wondered how hard that spell was to learn. By about 11 every morning, Quentin would hit his limit and flee the house for the relative safety of Chesterton, which stubbornly refused to reveal even the slightest hint of mystery or intrigue beneath its green, self-satisfied exterior. He had never learned to drive, so he rode his father's white 1970s-era 10-speed, which weighed approximately 1 metric ton, to the center of town. Out of deference to its glorious colonial heritage, the town was governed by a set of draconian zoning laws that kept everything in a state of permanent, unnatural quaintness. Knowing no one, caring about nothing, Quentin took a tour of the low-ceilinged, heavy-timbered residence of some revolutionary luminary. He inspected a boxy, white-painted Unitarian church, established 1766. He surveyed the lush, flat lawns where amateur continental irregulars had faced off against well-drilled, well-armed redcoats, with predictable results. There was one pleasant surprise hidden behind the church, a lovely half-vanished 17th-century graveyard, a little square glebe of ultra-green grass scattered with wet, saffron-colored elm leaves, with a bent wrought-iron fence around it. Inside it was cool and hushed. The gravestones were all winged skulls and bad devotional quatrains about whole families carried off by fever, weathered in places into illegibility. Quentin crouched down on the wet grass to try to decipher one very old one, a rectangle of blue slate that had split in half and sunk halfway into the green turf, which rose up to meet it like a wave. Quentin. He straightened up. A woman about his age had come in through the cemetery gate.
"Hi," he said cautiously. "How did she know his name?"
"I guess you didn't think I would find you," she said unsteadily.
"I guess you didn't think of that."
She walked right up to him. At the last possible moment, too late to do anything about it, he realized that she wasn't going to stop. Without breaking stride, she grabbed the front of his barn jacket and marched him stumbling backward over a low footstone right into the aromatic branches of a cypress tree. Her face, pushed right up in front of his, dangerously close, was an angry mask. It had been raining off and on all afternoon, and the needles were damp. He resisted the impulse to struggle. He wasn't going to be caught fighting a girl in a churchyard.
"Whoa, whoa, whoa," he said. "Stop, just stop."
"Now I'm here," she said, clinging precariously to her composure. "Now I'm here, and we are going to talk. You are going to deal with me."
Now that he had a closer look at her, he could see she was covered in warning signs. Her whole body screamed unbalance. She was too pale and too thin. Her eyes were too wild. Her long, dark hair was lank and smelled unwashed. She was dressed in a raggedy goth outfit. Her arms were wrapped in what looked like black electrical tape. There were scabby red scratches on the backs of her hands. He almost didn't recognize her.
"I was there, and you were there," Julia said, locking eyes with him.
"Weren't you? In that place, that school, or whatever it was, you got in, didn't you?"
He got it then. She had been at the exam after all. He hadn't been mistaken. But she hadn't made the cut. They'd culled her in the first round during the written test.
But this was all wrong. It wasn't supposed to happen. There were safeguards against it. Anybody who flunked the exam was supposed to have their memory gently, lovingly clouded by a faculty member and then overwritten with a plausible alibi. It wasn't simple, nor was it outrageously ethical, but the spells were humane and well understood. Except in her case, they hadn't worked, or not completely.
"Julia," he said. Their faces were very close together. There was nicotine on her breath.
"Julia, what are you doing here?"
"Don't pretend with me. Don't you dare pretend. You go to that school, don't you? The magic school?"
Quentin kept his face blank. It was a basic rule at Breakbills not to discuss the school with outsiders. He could get expelled. But whatever, if Fogg screwed up the memory spells, it wasn't Quentin's problem. And this was Julia. Her lovely, freckly face, so close to his, looked much older. Her skin was blotchy. She was in agony.
"All right," he said. "Okay, sure. I go there."
"I knew it!" she shrieked. She stamped her booted foot on the graveyard grass. From her reaction, he guessed that she'd been at least halfway bluffing. "I knew it was real! I knew it was real!" she said, mostly to herself. "I knew it wasn't a dream."
She bent over with her hands over her face, and one convulsive sob escaped her. Quentin took a deep breath. He readjusted his jacket.
"Listen," he said gently.
She was still doubled over. He bent down, putting a hand on her narrow back.
"Julia, you're not supposed to remember any of that stuff. They're supposed to make you forget if you don't get in."
"But I should have."
She straightened up with the flashing red eyes and cold, crystal seriousness of the true nut job.
"I was supposed to get in. I know I was. It was a mistake. Believe me, it was."
Her large eyes tried to burn into his.
"I'm like you. I can do real magic. I'm like you, see? That's why they couldn't make me forget."
Quentin saw. He could see everything. No wonder she'd been so altered the last time he saw her. That one glimpse through the curtain of the world behind the world had knocked her completely out of orbit. She'd seen it once, and she couldn't let go. Breakbills had ruined her. There was a time when he would have done anything for her, and he still would. He just didn't know what to do. Why did he feel so guilty? He took a deep breath.
"But that's not how it works. Even if you really can do magic, that wouldn't make you any more resistant to memory spells than anybody else."
She was staring at him hungrily. Everything he was saying just confirmed what she wanted to believe, that magic was real. He backed away just to put some distance between them, but she grabbed his sleeve.
"Oh, no, 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 no," she said with a brittle smile. "Q, please,
Wait, no, you're going to help me. That's why I came here.
She had dyed her hair black. It looked dry and burnt.
Julia, I want to. I just don't know what I can do. Just watch this. Watch.
She let go of his arm, reluctantly, as if she expected him to vanish or run away the instant she did. Incredibly, Julia launched into a basically correct version of a simple Basque optical spell called Ugarte's Prismatic Spray. She must have found it online. Some genuine magical information did circulate in the straight world, mostly on the Internet, though it was buried in so much bogus crap that nobody could tease out the real stuff, even if they could have used it. Quentin had even seen a Brake Bills blazer for sale on eBay. It was extremely rare, but not unheard of, for civilians to work up a spell or two on their own, but as far as Quentin knew, they never got into anything serious. Real magicians called them hedge witches. A few of them had careers as stage magicians, or set themselves up as cult demi-deities, gathering around themselves congregations of Wiccans and Satanists and oddball Christian outliers. Julia proclaimed the words of the spell theatrically, over-articulating, like she was doing Summerstock Shakespeare. She had no idea what she was doing. Quentin glanced nervously at the doorway at the back of the church.
Look!
She held up her hand defiantly. The spell had actually worked, sort of. Her bitten-down fingertips left faint, radiant rainbow trails in the air. She waved them around, making mystical gestures like an interpretive dancer. Ugarte's prismatic spray was a totally useless spell. Quentin felt a pang when he thought about how many months, if not years, it must have cost her to figure it out.
"See?" she demanded, close to tears. "You see it too, right? It's not too late for me. I won't go back to college. Tell them. Tell them I could still come."
"Does James know?"
She shook her head tightly. "He wouldn't understand. I don't see him anymore."
He wanted to help her, but there was no way to. It was far, far too late. Better to be blunt about it. This could have been me, he thought. This was almost me.
"I don't think there's anything I can do," he said. "It's not up to me. I've never heard of them changing their minds. No one ever gets a second exam."
But Alice got an exam, he thought, even though she wasn't invited.
"You could tell them, though. You can't decide, but you can tell them I'm here, right? That I'm still out here. You can at least do that."
She grabbed his arm again, and he had to mutter a quick counterspell to snuff out the prismatic spray. That stuff could eat into fabric.
"Just tell them you saw me,"
she said urgently, her eyes full of dying hope.
"Please. I've been practicing. You can teach me. I'll be your apprentice. I'll do whatever you need. I have an aunt who lives in Winchester. I can live with her." "Or what do you need, Quentin?"
She moved closer to him, just slightly, so that her knee touched his knee. In spite of himself, he felt the old electrical field form between them. She hazarded a curvy, sardonic smile, letting the moment hang in the air.
"Maybe we can help each other. You used to want my help."
He was angry at himself for being tempted. He was angry at the world for being this way. He wanted to yell obscenities. It would have been terrible to see anybody scrape the bottom like this, but her. It should have been anybody but her. "She has already seen more unhappiness," Quentin thought, "than I will ever see in my life." "Listen to me," he said. "Julia, if I tell them, they're just going to find you and wipe your memory. For real, this time."
"They can try," she snarled, suddenly fierce. "They tried once already."
She breathed hard through pinched white nostrils.
"Just tell me where it is. where we were. I've been looking for it. Just tell me where the school is, and I'll leave you alone.
Quentin could only imagine the kind of shit he'd be in if Julia showed up at the house, hell-bent on matriculating, and dropped his name. It's in upstate New York, on the Hudson somewhere. I don't know exactly where. I really don't. It's near West Point. They make it invisible. Even I don't know how to find it. But I'll tell them about you, if that's truly what you want. He was just making it worse. Maybe he should have bluffed her after all, he thought. Tried harder to lie. Too late. She put her arms around him as if she were too exhausted by relief and despair to stand anymore, and he held her. There was a time when this was everything he wanted.
"They couldn't make me forget," she whispered into his chest. "Do you understand that? They couldn't make me forget."
He could feel her heart beating, and the word he heard when it beat was, "Shame. Shame, shame." He wondered why they hadn't taken her. If anybody should have gone to Breakbills, it was her, not him. But they really would wipe her memory this time, he thought. Fog would make sure this time. She'd be happier that way anyway. She could get back on track, go back to college, get back together with James, get on with her life. It would all be for the best. By next morning, he was back at Breakbills. The others were already there. They were surprised he'd lasted as long as he did. The most any of them had spent at home was 48 hours. Elliot hadn't gone home at all. It was cool and quiet in the cottage. Quentin felt safe again. He was back where he belonged. Elliot was in the kitchen with a dozen eggs and a bottle of brandy, trying to make flips, which nobody wanted, but which he was determined to make anyway. Josh and Janet were playing an idiotic card game called Push. It was basically the magical equivalent of War that was wildly popular at Breakbills. Quentin just used it as a chance to show off his card-handling skills, which was why nobody ever wanted to play with him anymore. While they played, Janet told the story of Alice's Antarctic ordeal, despite the fact that everybody except Quentin had heard it already, and Alice herself was right there in the room, silently paging through an old herbal in the window seat. Quentin didn't know how he would feel about seeing Alice again, after he'd made such a comprehensive mess of their last conversation, but to his amazed relief, and despite every possible reason to the contrary, it wasn't awkward at all. It was perfect. His heart clenched with silent happiness when he saw her.
"And then when Mayakovsky tried to give her the bag of sheep fat, she threw it back in his face."
"I meant to hand it back to him," Alice said quietly from the window seat, "but it was so cold and I was shaking so badly I sort of flung it at him. He was all, 'Chort fuzz me.'"
"Why didn't you just take it?"
"I don't know." She put the book down. "I'd made all these plans for getting by without it. It just threw me off. Plus, I wanted him to stop looking at me naked. And anyway, I didn't know he was going to have mutton fat for us. I hadn't even prepared the Schkartisvili."
That was a white lie. Like Alice couldn't have cast Schkartisvili cold.
He had missed her so much.
"So what did you do for heat?" he said.
"I tried using some of those German thermogenesis charms, but they kept fading away whenever I fell asleep. By the second night, I was waking myself up every 15 minutes just to make sure I was still alive. By the third day, I was losing my mind. So I ended up using a tweaked Miller flare."
"I don't get it," Josh frowned. "How is that supposed to help?"
"If you kind of mangle it a little, it becomes inefficient. The extra energy comes out as heat instead of light."
"You know you could have cooked yourself by accident," Janet said.
"I know, but when I realized the German thing wasn't going to work, I couldn't think of anything else."
I think I saw you once, Quentin said quietly. At night.
You couldn't have missed me. I looked like a road flare.
A naked road flare, Josh said. Elliot came in with a tureen full of viscous, unappetizing flip and began ladling it into teacups. Alice picked up her book and headed for the stairs.
Hang on, I'm coming back with the hot ones, Elliot called, busily grating nutmeg.
Quentin didn't hang on. He followed Alice. At first he'd thought everything would be different between him and Alice. Then he thought everything was back to normal. Now he understood that he didn't want things to be back to normal. He couldn't stop looking at her, even after she'd looked at him, seen him looking at her, and looked away in embarrassment again. It was like she'd become charged in some way that drew him to her uncontrollably. He could sense her naked body inside her dress, smell it like a vampire smells blood. Maybe Mayakovsky hadn't quite managed to get all the fox out of him.
He found her in one of the upstairs bedrooms. She was lying on one of a pair of twin beds on top of the bedspread, reading. It was dim and hot. The roof slanted in at an odd angle. The room was full of odd, old furniture. A wicker chair with a staved-in seat, a dresser with a stuck drawer. And it had deep red wallpaper that didn't match any other room in the house.
Quentin yanked up the window halfway. It made an outraged squawk and flopped down on the other twin bed.
Can you believe they have these here? It's a full set. They were in the bookcase in the bathroom.
She held up the book she was reading. Incredibly, it was an old copy of The World in the Walls.
I had that exact same edition.
The cover showed Martin Chatwin halfway through the old grandfather clock, with his feet still in this world and his amazed head poking into Fillory, which was drawn as a groovy 1970s disco winter wonderland.
I haven't looked at them for years. God, remember the cozy horse? That big velvet horse that would just carry you around? I wanted one so badly when I was that age. Did you read them?
Quentin wasn't sure how much to reveal about his Fillory obsession.
I may have taken a look.
Alice smirked and went back to the book.
Why is it that you still think you can keep secrets from me?
Quentin folded his hands behind his head and lay back on the pillow and looked up at the low, tilted ceiling. This wasn't right. There was something brother-sister about it.
Here, budge over.
He switched beds and lay down next to Alice, hip-checking her sideways to make room on the narrow bed. She held up the paperback and they read together silently for a few pages. Their shoulders and upper arms touched. Quentin felt like the bed was on a train, moving very fast, and if he looked out the window, he'd see the landscape racing past. They were both breathing very carefully.
I never got it about the cozy horse, Quentin said after a while. First of all, there's only one of it. Is there a whole herd of cozy horses somewhere? And then it's too useful. You'd think somebody would have domesticated it by now.
She whacked his head with the spine, not completely gently.
Somebody evil? You can't break the cozy horse. The cozy horse is a free spirit. Anyway, it's too big. I always figured it was mechanical. Somebody made it somehow.
Like who?
I don't know. A magician. Somebody in the past. Anyway, the cozy horse is a girl thing.
Janet stuck her head in. Apparently the exodus downstairs was general.
Ah! Janet brayed. I can't believe you're reading that.
Alice scooched an inch away from him instinctively, but he didn't move.
Like you didn't, Quentin said. Of course I did. When I was 9, I made my family call me Fiona for 2 weeks.
She vanished, leaving behind a comfortable,
echoless silence. The room was cooling down as hot air ascended out through the half-open window. Quentin imagined it rising in an invisible braided plume into the blue summer day. "Did you know there really was a Chatwin family?" he asked. "In real life? Supposedly they lived next door to Plover." Alice nodded. She unscooched now that Janet was gone.
"It's sad, though."
"Sad how?"
"Well, do you know what happened to them?"
Quentin shook his head.
"There's a book about it. Most of them grew up to be pretty boring. Housewives and insurance magnates and whatnot. I think one of the boys married an heiress. I know one got killed in World War II. But you know the thing about Martin?"
Quentin shook his head.
"Well, you know how he disappears in the book? He really did disappear. He ran away or had an accident or something. One day after breakfast, he just vanished, and they never saw him again."
"The real Martin?"
"The real Martin."
"God, that is sad."
He tried to imagine it, a big, fresh-faced, floppy-haired English family. He pictured them in a sepia-toned family portrait in tennis whites,
suddenly with a gaping hole opening in the middle of it. The somber announcement, the slow, decorous acceptance, the lingering damage.
"It makes me think of my brother," Alice said.
"I know." At this, she looked at him sharply. He looked back.
It was true. He did know.
He propped himself up on one elbow so he could look down at her, the air around him whirling with excited dust motes.
"When I was little," he said slowly,
"and even when I was not so little, I used to envy Martin." She smiled up at him.
"I know. Because I thought he'd finally done it. I know it was supposed to be a tragedy, but to me it was like he broke the bank, beat the system. He got to stay in Fillory forever."
"I know. I get it."
She put a restraining hand on his chest.
"That's what makes you different from the rest of us, Quentin. You actually still believe in magic. You do realize, right, that nobody else does. I mean, we all know magic is real, but you really believe in it, don't you?"
He felt flustered.
"Is that wrong?"
She nodded and smiled even more brightly.
"Yes, Quentin, it's wrong."
He kissed her, softly at first. Then he got up and locked the door. And that's how it started, though of course it had been starting for a long time. At first it was like they were getting away with something, as if they half expected someone or something to stop them. When nothing happened, and there were no consequences, they lost control. They ravenously, roughly pulled each other's clothes off, not just out of desire for each other, but out of a pure desire to lose control. It was like a fantasy. The sound of breathing and rustling cloth was thunderous in the little chaste bedroom. God only knew what they could hear downstairs. He wanted to push her, to see if she had it as bad as he did, to see how far she'd go and how far she'd let him go. She didn't stop him. She pushed him ever further. It wasn't his first time, or even his first time with Alice, technically, but this was different. This was real human sex, and it was so much better just because they weren't animals, because they were civilized and prudish and self-conscious humans who transformed into sweaty, lustful, naked beasts, not through magic, but because that's who, on some level, they really were all along. They tried to be discreet about it. They barely even discussed it between themselves. But the others knew, and they came up with excuses to leave the two of them alone, and Quentin and Alice took them. Probably they were relieved that the tension between them was finally over. In its way, the fact that Alice wanted Quentin as much as he wanted her was as much of a miracle as anything else he'd seen since he came to Brakebills, and no easier to believe, though he had no choice but to believe it. His love for Julia had been a liability, a dangerous force that lashed him to cold, empty Brooklyn. Alice's love was so much more real, and it bound him finally and for good to his new life, his real life.